Record.
Hello, everybody. My name is Jim, and I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank Al-Anon from the bottom of my heart, because it's done a lot for me, even though I'm not in it. And thank you, Ray, too. I see a lot of old-timers here, and is this microphone on or not?
Yes.
Not. They're saying not. What do I do? Okay.
Is that good?
Hey, that's good.
Trying to get your drink.
See a lot of old-timers. I was wondering, though, how many people might be here in, say, the first 3 months of sobriety. Are there any? There. It's a good thing you surrendered, because we have you surrounded. And we have you on an island. That's just great. It's a privilege to be here and to say that my name is Jim and I'm an alcoholic. And I want to tell you why, just a little bit. It was on December 10th, 1982, about 6 months before I got sober. It was the end of the school semester, and I used to teach at Michigan State. And there was a person there that I'd hired that I hadn't paid attention to, so I asked her out for lunch. And it turned out to be about 4 o'clock. They told us lunch was over and that we should leave. And she liked to drink like I did, as it turned out. And so we, as it turns out, too, left our raincoats behind. And I took her home to a place about 2 miles from where I lived. And I was going to take her upstairs to her apartment to escort her home, but I couldn't negotiate the stairs. So that was off. And she had walked into a wall, and she was holding her eye. So I decided I'd better go home. It was getting, I needed to get home. As it was well after 4 by then, and I got in my car, and I couldn't remember where I lived. Some of you are nodding your heads. I couldn't remember where I lived. And that really frightened me. So I thought, well, what do I do? I knew. I'll say my name, and then I'll know where I live. And I couldn't remember my name. Well, I sat there, and I started to sing something I'd been taught in kindergarten. Remember your name and address, your telephone number, too. Go up to the kind policeman. Da-da-da-da-da. That apparently started me into name recognition. And I drove home the 2 miles and then went on with the rest of my life. You know how that is. And I'm also glad to be up here to speak. I'll tell you why about that, too. A number of years before I got sober, I was asked to, as a good professor, go give a talk about a very complicated novel called Gravity's Rainbow by Thomas Pynchon, just a beast of a book, hard to understand. And I was asked to go talk about it at a national conference, and there were going to be a lot of people there I knew, as many as in this room. And the talk was to be at 12 o'clock. And I was nervous about that talk because I knew that I didn't know everything about that book. And I knew there were sharpshooters in the audience who, when I finished, would be all over me. So I was anxious. So it was to be at noon. So at 10, I decided I'd have a drink to calm down. But I had reached a state of my drinking where having a drink didn't calm me down. It got me more anxious, right? So you know what I did about that. I had another drink, and I had another drink. And I knew that I was not in good shape by the time it was to speak. So I walked out onto that stage, and sure enough, all those people were out there. And I decided I had a strategy. Since it was such a complex novel, and I had a complex speech to do about it. I would just do it real fast, and nobody would understand it. And then I wouldn't get any of those sharpshooter questions. And so that's what I did. And it was a humiliating experience. Public humiliation, I used to try to avoid that at all costs. But it kept happening. And that was one of the times. But it was an important experience. I knew exactly what I had to do. I had to quit. And I quit cold turkey. I didn't give another speech for 7 or 8 years until after I got sober. So I'm glad that I can tell you my name, and I'm glad that I'm up here, and I will try to slow down so that you understand me. You know what? You understand me anyway. Fast or slow. Oh, that's so good. Oh, true fellowship. I didn't know that was a topic either, but it's so wonderful. It's so good. I was out, we were out to dinner Saturday night tonight with another couple, and he was telling me that his 10-month-old grandchild likes to be read to by his father. Mm. You know, and that just struck me because I've always loved stories. Always loved them. My mother read to me, that's maybe my favorite childhood memory, and like a lot of you, I don't have a lot of them. No, I'm not going to talk about those. We know about them. And I read a lot when I was a kid. I also, you know, I did sports, and I did a lot of those good things that kids do, because I tried to be perfect, you know, because I was perfect, I was going to be safe. But I like to read. Just like to read, and I can't tell you exactly why I love stories. Even when I went off to college when I was 17 years old, started to really learn how to drink, I was interested in the sciences, I thought, but I found myself reading fiction and poetry all the time. And that went on to the point where I had to recognize that I probably better major in English. Actually, an advisor saw that because, you know, my other grades weren't all that hot. And there it was, and that went on. And I love that because I found out about fiction that it was often more true than anything else. It spoke to me. I trusted the person speaking through those words to me. And I didn't trust. I just did. And that was important to me, those stories. And I could see below the surface. And I understood. If I understood that stuff, I would be okay. But, you know, it kept getting so I wasn't okay, so that wasn't the whole story. Besides that, I was reading people like Hemingway and Dos Passos and Faulkner and Jack London, and if you know the literature, you know they were all alcoholics. I mean, I even eventually wrote a book, and I gave it a title. I didn't know where the title came from, so I searched around. I knew it was in Jack London's works, but I didn't know where, and I finally found it, and it was from his book, John Barleycorn, His Alcoholic Memoirs, Made to Order. So, but that literature, as important was, as rich as it was, and just didn't do it in that way. So I love it when people ask me about AA. You know, people aren't AA, and they say, you're still going, you know, that old thing. And I say, yeah, I'm still going. They say, well, what do you do? What do you do there? I say, well, we go and tell stories. We tell stories. We're in a room and we go around and we tell stories. And they kind of look at me, oh, that's nice. And that's it. But I do understand about stories. I do. And I like being up here because we're up here where I was reading today, reading signs around here about the Native Americans around here. And what I know is that any group doesn't have a written language, they get to sit around, you know, sit around campfires or sit around wherever, sit around in the dark together, and they tell stories. And they are entertaining, but they're so much more than that. Because they're also about how that tribe or that clan survives. How to do a good hunt so you don't starve. How to have a spiritual life. Those are serious. But they are entertaining too. And that's AA for me. We're a special tribe, a special clan, whatever we are, a special fellowship, a true fellowship, We tell stories that help us survive. Help us figure out how to be good people. How to relate to others. Thank God for that. Anyway, I mentioned God today, but you know, I wasn't... I'll tell you a couple things on how I was not equipped for fellowship first, and now I'll get on, you know, claim my seat. I'm not going to tell you all sorry, but I'm going to tell you enough so that you know that I belong here. And just like you do. Something about my... You know, as I was in grade school, the worst grade you could get then was needs to improve. And guess what? I always got, oh man, needs to improve in social attitudes and habits. I mean, I wasn't good at true fellowship 101. I just wasn't good at that. I was always in trouble. A little immature or something like that, anyway. Okay, a couple stories as a grown person, not being too mature. Let me think. Okay. My wife Sally's over here. She used to be a music teacher, then a school principal. Okay. So at the end of one school year, they had a school picnic. And it was in a local park in East Lansing, Michigan. And, oh boy. And so the school was gathered, and she invited me to come, you know. And I liked being a good husband. I worked hard at being a good husband. I worked hard at being a good father. I worked hard at everything, you know. And so, but it was at 4 o'clock. And, of course, by 4 o'clock, I was ripped. But I decided I should do this anyway. So I got over there to the park. And I could see them sort of gathered off over there, Sally and the kids and other teachers, and some of them a little closer. But I knew I couldn't walk there. I knew I would stumble and fall. But they had a kind of one of those chain link fences around, and there were some of them right near that. So I went over that chain link fence and I took my belt buckle off and I buckled it around on the chain link fence so I wouldn't fall down, and I beckoned people over to me because I couldn't get over to them. Hello, children. Hello, teachers. Night step. Okay, that was one example. That was the one I was reasonably social. Let's see. Here's another one. I'm not going to do a drunk one. I never do. Cause you know how to do all this stuff. Being sober, that's our problem. Anyway. Other lack of social skills, let's see. Someone was telling me I ought to mention this one. What was it? Oh, yeah. It had gotten to be mid-evening, gotten dark. I'd had dinner. So I was doing something. The kids were going off to bed. And I was lonely for some kind of companionship. So I got in my car, out for an adventure. I didn't know what it would be. But I stopped off at a party store, and I thought, I'm going to get some things to drink that I've heard of that I've never had. You know, let's liven up things, you know, spice it up. And so I got some Boone's apple, something or other, you know, Ripple, I think, something, these things. But that wasn't, I drank just a cut above that. So I got those, and I went out to a place called the Crest Drive-In. You've been there. Oh, it's not there anymore. St. Martha's Church is there. Yeah. This was before you could get videos easily. So it was a triple X place. See, I don't remember what year this was. But anyway, I said, this is my social life I'm telling you about. Remember? True fellowship. So I got out there and go in and... You know, it's great. We crunch up and get the car up there in a little incline and crank down the window and put in the speaker, crank up and say, okay. And I drank some stuff and I couldn't quite see what's going on. I wish I could. You know, was not used to going. This was the first time I'd ever been to a place like this. Don't know what age I was, but that's the way it was then. And I must have fallen asleep. Dozed off, you know. Passed out. But all of a sudden, I'm waking up, and there's blue lights, and a big voice saying on a loudspeaker, First Amendment, blah, blah, we value our patrons. All that kind of stuff. Well, I've been raided, see. Yeah. I immediately am clear-headed enough to think, of next day's front page paper. You know, Professor Jim, you know, Michigan State, noteworthy, you know, rounded up at the local porno. Blah, blah, blah. So I know I got to get out of there. All right? So I very carefully started the car. I kept the lights off. I knew better than that, right? I thought, oh, they're going to see me. So I'll keep my head down. So I opened the door so I could look out under the door to see where it's moving here. I peek up once in a while. And I remember going and thinking, oh, if I go out the wrong way, there's those spikes. You know, I'm going to puncture the tires. Oh, man. Ooh, but I got out. I got out, man. I drive home. I go in the driveway. I go to bed. I sleep. I get up in the morning. In those days, I wear coat and tie. Da-da. Coat and tie. And I don't remember anything about it. I don't care about the night before. But I get out and I go to get in the car, and there's something wrong, right? You know what it is. Yeah, speaker's dangling. Well, then, it's not for that. So now we'll have a social event where I wasn't even there. So there's no true fellowship. Or I didn't know I was there. But I was there. Okay. I went to a party. And I guess it was a good party. But a couple days later, you know what I'm going to say. Done. A couple days later, I got a phone call from this dean at the university. And I can tell from the conversation that I have agreed to go to teach for a year in mainland China. This was not good news. Oh, I didn't know about China. I didn't care about China. It was like that ad. I couldn't point it to it on the map. My specialty was American stuff, you know. So I say to Sally, guess what, Sally? We're going to China. And she said, no. 5 years before, we'd spend a year in Poland because I'd gone there because, well, you know, geographical cure. Don't go to Poland for a cure. If you're new here, don't go to Poland for a cure. Stick with us. That was a bad year. Anyway, so I come back sick. So anyway, I had given my word, so I was going to go to China. So okay, believe it or not, this got me to AA because I was terrified. And I was drinking a lot, and that's about the time I started, you know, that I couldn't remember my name stuff. And I'd wake up from things like, oh, I'm waking up. What's going on? Oh, I'm teaching. Oh, these are students. You know, I didn't get in trouble. No, but I was in trouble. So I had to get a physical exam to go to China. And I went to this guy, and I don't know why, except for that famous grace we talked about, the higher power we talked about, I said to him, I think I'm an alcoholic. He gave me the 20 questions. I responded appropriately. He agreed with my diagnosis. He said, what do you want to do? And I said, basically, I'm willing to do anything except go to AA. He said, I might want to change my mind. So I left. I left. Scared, confused, lost, everything. I went back to my office. I took the bottles out of my drawers. And I took them next door to the guy who was a chemist there, who I knew a little bit. Knocked on his door, handed him these things. He was a little startled. And I said, I've just been to the doctor. He told me I'm allergic to alcohol and I can't drink anymore. He said, okay. It's nice. Took the bottles. But I didn't know what to do after that. But I knew one guy in AA. It's the only connection I had with AA. All I knew AA was about God, and I didn't want it. You know, that old story. And I went to, I got Howard out of a party on a sunny day, and I said, Howard, for God's sake, can you help me? I've got to stop drinking. I don't know what he said to me then. He said he thought he could. He said, no. He said, are you willing to go to any lengths? That phrase I got to hear. And I said, yeah, I am. Except go to AA. And he said, Jim, I love you, but I can't help you. And he turned around. And then I got hold of him. I said, okay. And I went to a meeting. June 2nd, 1983. I went to a meeting. And I didn't know what that was. It was down in the church basement. And I remember going down, amazed, you know, going through the hallways thinking, boy, I'll never be able to get out of here. You know, and I don't have a black mask. Everybody else is going to have a black mask when I get there, and I don't have one. You know, none of us. And I went into the room, and they had a sign on the wall, because it was church. It wasn't an AA sign, but it might as well be. It says, God doesn't make junk. And the tears, you know, because I know who I was. And they set me down. I was sitting between two people, and one of them was Dick over there. Raise your hand, Dick. You gotta. Okay. And shortly thereafter, he was my sponsor. And another guy, too, named Dr. Jerry. They had me well covered. And after the meeting, I was taken out to coffee by Pat. Where are you, Pat? Pat, you're here. Stick your hand. Oh, there. She's short, so her hand doesn't go up too high. She's right over there. Yeah. She took me out to coffee with two others, a guy named Byrne and a guy named Charlie, and we went to a big party, because I don't know these people. I don't even know what's going on, right? I mean, how could I? We went to Big Boy, and they sat me between them, and Byrne weighed 350, maybe more? 400, okay. Charlie weighed 100? Yeah. And there was Pat. And me, and they talked. And Pat had been in Germany, and she'd gone to AA meetings. Whew. I was going to China. Wow. And Bert and Charlie, they just talked. I didn't know what to say. I didn't have to say anything. I felt safe. I know now, I felt like a little child saved for the first time. Well, I got started on AA boot camp with Dick. He was great. He gave me a book, and he said, you're on the first step, whatever that is. He said, you're on the first step, call me every morning, and we'll talk about the first step as it fits into your life. And I'd call up, and I'd say, Sally this, or Sally that, and he'd say, well, what's that have to do with the first step? And I'd think about it, and then I'd go, I figured it out, you know, figured it out, day after day after day. He'd say, you know, things like, pray for her, and I said, well, I don't believe in God, I don't pray. Just do it. I did it. It worked. And that way, step one filtered into my everyday life. Until we were step two. And that filtered into my everyday life. Then there was step three. He kept saying before that, don't worry about it, you're not there. Well, I was there. So what do? He said, do what it says in the book. Okay. Saw the book and said, you know, about the key of willingness. We'll open the door to faith. Okay. So I knew how to meditate a little bit, so I decided that would be my meditation. To start to read the books, you know, about step three. I'll meditate on that key going into the door. And I'll turn it. And I'll open the door. So I did that. It was just as real as anything to me. Opened the door a little bit, and I thought, here's when I find out if all those superstitions are true or not. God will either come through that door and fill in my heart, blah, 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 you know, and say to myself, didn't happen. But I didn't change for some reason. I was in this wonderful state of kind of quiet. So I don't know why, but I thought, I'll just imagine pushing that door open and I'll walk through it. And I did. And I had an overwhelming experience. That experience was that somehow I had rejoined the human race. I don't know if it was rejoined. I joined it. In my heart, I had found a true fellowship. No doubt about it. I didn't think that was the first step. I told him about it, and he said it was. That was good enough. So what do I do now? What's got right? And I did that. And all that. And then I heard after a meeting, a kind of sweaty men's meeting, loud and all that, jammed up after the meeting, and I heard Dick and Dr. Jerry talking about me, and they didn't know I was hearing. And I heard him say, we've got to get Jim to do a fifth step before he goes to China, or he's going to die drunk there. And I'll tell you, you can hear that a couple ways, but I heard it as good news. That meant to me that if I did a fifth step before I went to China, I was not going to die drunk there. So I got on it. I got on with it. And I did it. You know, it was the first one. But I was willing, and I did it. On August 20th, 1923, I got on an airplane in Lansing, Michigan, and by myself. Sally and two kids would come 6 months later. We had worked out an agreement. By myself, 30 hours later, I was in Xi'an, China, which, if you don't know China like I did it, it's sort of like in the middle. You know, because the United States maybe would be Lincoln, Nebraska, I don't know. But it didn't look like Lincoln, Nebraska. And there I was. And 2 months sober. And I went into the room they gave me. It was like in a cinder block garage. A room in it. And I went in there, and there was a packet on my bed, and it was from Central. And I opened up the packet, and it was a letter, and it said, "Dear Jim, my name is Lois, and I'm an alcoholic. We're at Central AA, and we're going to send a meeting by mail every month. And we put your name in a directory through the loaners program, where your name is in there with other people at places where there are no meetings. There were none. And people can write to you if they want to." So I wasn't alone. And they had a banquet for me that night. And, I'm going too slow here, but I'll tell you about this banquet. When I got to the banquet, they had a lot of people, round tables, and in front of me they had beer, some kind of wine, another kind of wine that was white and rice wine, and gumbay, something like that. Baijiu, yeah. Which is not like petroleum oil, but with some version of vodka. And they said, everybody stood up and they said, "A toast to Chinese-American relations, you know, friendship." And I stood up and I said, "I can't toast." And the Chinese guy next to me, or anybody else like me, he said in English, "Well, I had to do it." And I said, "Well, I really couldn't." He said, "We went to a lot of trouble." He's pretty candid. And then I hit the right thing. I said, "Well, I'm allergic to alcohol. My doctor says if I drink it, I'll fall down, you know, unconscious." Which is sort of true. So I said, "Oh, doctor, doctor," everybody, "Oh, yeah, doctor, doctor, doctor." And then 5 minutes later, someone comes in the room with this orange soda, which they call qishui, gas water. And wherever I went in China that year, which was a lot of places, they knew ahead of time to have the gas water ready. They weren't going to have me be unconscious. A lot of other things happened there. At least 24 people wrote to me regularly from around the world. One of them became my sponsor, a guy in Wales who had gotten sober in prison and gotten out and was very strong in AA. And 4 years after I got back from China, we went to visit him in Wales, in England, met him. It was quite an experience. Sally and the kids came. That family healing started, mostly by me not having to be a know-it-all, being able to say I'm wrong, which was novel for me. And they went back home early, and I had to stay for a while. And on my one-year anniversary, knocking the door, and there was a woman there from North Dakota or South Dakota, a petroleum engineer who had gone 600 miles out of her way to give me my one-year coin. Okay, that year went by. I came home. Boy, was I glad to go to meetings. I hadn't been to that many. You know? And I went, and what happened? Well, a guy asked me to sponsor him. What did I know? So I asked my sponsor if I should do that. And he said, "Yeah, you should do that, but get some help." So we co-sponsored this guy, Ken. And he was in long-term treatment, and I talked to him a long time. We got along great. We're so different. We got along great. Talk program every day. Then he got out of treatment, and he got a job, and he needed a car to do his job. So I loaned him a car. Then Ken left. My car went away. And I was worried, you know, a lot. He was going to run over or whatever. And we had to go to meeting, and say, I did well, everybody would laugh. And so finally somebody ran into Ken on the street, and they asked him for the keys, and he gave it back. And then I got my car back, and pizza boxes, and Budweiser cans, and all that. Ken helped me a lot. I know not to carry the alcohol. Carry the message. That's enough. You know. And I got to work on the rest of the steps with Dick's help and everybody's help, Jerry's help. And I still work on those steps. I can't go through them all, but it's still alive with me. It's never done. I'm 24 years sober, and not too long ago, I was helping with the fifth step with a guy that I sponsored, some of us. And he had down among his character defects that he was unforgiving. I had never noticed that, never thought about that. And it struck me to my heart that I had been bothered with a couple of resentments the whole time that I'd worked on them, that I'd done all the things we do about them, pray about them, all that stuff. I had done it. But somehow when he said that he was unforgiving, it unlocked that. And those two resentments just went. How is that? I don't know. But I'm glad that I was serving enough to do it. He thinks I was helping him with the fifth step. Whoa. Big change in my life. And so I went through the steps there. And a few years ago I retired and we spent our summers, poor us, on the main coast. But I was worried about going there. Because I had no connection with Maine. It's like going to China. I don't know. And I was worried when I got there that the AA people wouldn't accept me, you know. I'm sober long enough, I should know better than that, but that's the way, you know, East Coast, Maine, blah, blah, blah. Didn't know. So, and I was worried. I didn't have anybody to sponsor there. You know, sponsoring is a big important part of my life. Every day talking with people at that level, at a profound, loving, caring level, changed me. I like that change. I need a change. As Don said at one of these things years ago, as I remember, the person I used to be will drink again. I need to change. I need to keep changing. So I got the name, and what happened? I went to a meeting, and their custom there was anybody who's kind of new, new to that meeting, you ask them to chair. When you chair, you speak for 15 minutes or so. Well, I go to a meeting, you know, four or five times a week. I could go to different meetings, and they ask me to chair. So after two or three weeks, everywhere I go, hi Jim, down the street, hi Jim. And we have this electrician come over, he's doing work for us, and he's not an AA. He comes over and he says, Jim, how come everybody in town knows you? I said, well, we're new here, we're spending a lot of money. He said, no, some of these people don't have a pot, you know. And I'm going, well, like who? And he says, well, old Alex. Oh, God, he says, Alex, terrible drunk. He used to drink terrible, he doesn't drink anymore. He did a few other people, said the same thing. Oh, terrible. He used to drink a lot. He doesn't drink anymore. This guy never got it. But I was in the midst of true fellowship. You bet. You bet I was. And then one day, not too long after that, this guy, Jay, who was going around there, Jay the Winer, not because he drank wine. My wife, my job, And I'm afraid of this. Nobody wanted to sponsor him. They gave him a cup that had a big one, you know, it said Winer, a big circle around with a slash through. Yeah. They're rough there. So I knew he wanted me to sponsor him. I was really happy. And he asked me, you know, he popped the question. You know. And so I said to Jay, okay, because Dick taught me this, you know, you call me tomorrow morning, first step. And we'll talk about it in relationship to your wife, right? And life. And he did. And we talked. And I knew there, so people would come up to meetings after a while, after, I don't know, what, 6, 8 weeks, something like that, come up and say, oh, you know, Jay, you don't know how he's changed. You don't know what he used to be like. And that's where changed him. They were changing him. And I go away for a winter. I love this part. I go away from there, so I get to come back there and see how people have changed, just like I come back here and see how people have changed. And I came back and went to a meeting as soon as I was there. It was a Thursday night. It was a big crowd. I walk in the room. There's a new guy there. I was like that. Thank you for being here, new people. There he was, and they have a raffle at that meeting, and I won the raffle. So I went over to pick up a big book because I could take it over to the new guy, you know, of course. So I go over and I get the big book and I wend my way through the crowd to the new guy. But when I get there, there's Jay ahead of me. And I hear him saying, you know what? You call me in the morning. Yeah. He was passing on. Jay's now been sober, I don't know, 10 years or so, but he's also taken AA into the prison system. You know. Isn't that wonderful? True fellowship indeed. And it's around the world. I'm going to say a few things just about that, and then I'll quit, because I know it's getting late. I've been very lucky to go many places sober, as well as not sober. Sober's better. And when I go to meetings. Because I love it. I've been to some wonderful ones. I mentioned we were in Poland for a year. We were back in Poland this winter, just to see how things are there and see some people. And there was no AA in Poland when we were living there, because at that time it was the communist regime. You couldn't tell anybody, you know, the truth about yourself, of course. But AA's been there for 20 years now. And aren't they proud? And I went to those meetings, and of course I felt connected. And then a couple years ago, Sally does a lot of things helpful in South Africa. And we went there, just a few years after the end of apartheid when, you know, white, blacks, colors, whatever they like to call themselves there, were killing each other. And we went to an AA and an Al-Anon meeting in Durban, South Africa. And guess who was there? We were there. But white, black, color, burying alive. Getting better. True democracy. The real thing. True fellowship. Tell you last thing about, because I want to end this way. About Bern and Charlie, whom I mentioned early on, remember, went out to coffee with me and with Pat? Well, a few years ago, I came back from somewhere, and it was, I went to a meeting, a Thursday night, a men's meeting in the hospital, and, we were gathered, small group, fairly small group, and the door opens, and here comes Bern, Big Bern, remember, big heavy guy, wheeling in a little Charlie. And Charlie doesn't have his legs. He had them amputated. And Bern pushed Charlie up next to me, and I took his hand, he squeezed it, so I knew he was there, you know. He was stressed. And he had his head down on the table most of the meeting. Kind of occasionally put it up and listen. And went around the room, and so everybody gets to talk to that meeting, and came around. Those are the last two left. And Bern gets to talk, and Bern said what Bern used to say. I mean, Bern helped, let me preface it by, Bern helped a lot of people that other people wouldn't or couldn't help. But Bern was a humbug guy. Things were always wrong. Oh, I know it's the day before Christmas, he says, and I know it's fine with everybody. Everybody's saying these nice things, but I want you to know my life is. You know, on. He goes with us, the eyeballs start to roll around the room. But he finishes, and then Charlie's the last one. He's got his head down. So wait a minute, he didn't respond. And the chairperson said, anybody else, you know, and Charlie pops up. Charlie's head pops up, and he says, oh, I'm Charlie and I'm an alcoholic and I want to say something about Bern. He said, you know, I'm not doing too well. And he said, a month or so ago, I was at home, I was living at home, still had my legs, and the doorbell rings around dinner time. And I look out the window and there's Bern. And I think, oh, there goes my food budget. But I let him in. And Bern says, is there anything I can do around here? And yeah, do some things. Well, Bern helped out. And Bern came back the next day. He helped out the next day. And he helped out the next day. He's coming over regularly. And then Bern saw, Charlie said, he saw that I couldn't do well at night. I couldn't get up when I needed to. So Bern moved in, and he picked me up tonight. And Charlie was quite famous and much loved. But Charlie was the classic agnostic throughout his AA, many years of AA experience. Helped a lot of people, but that's who he was. He didn't want to hear about that other stuff and all that. Some of you know him and you're smiling. But he said, this is the last words I heard from Charlie. He died the next week. He said, I want you to know, because of Bern, I know that there's a higher power and its name is love. True fellowship. Big as this fellowship is, I could say. says at the end of the preface to the third edition, big as it is, and as complicated as it is, or not complicated, as big as it is, it's still a simple program. And recovery begins when one recovering alcoholic talks to another. It continues and continues. It started when Pat talked to me, Dick talked to me, Charlie talked to me, Vern talked to me, I talked to others. We all talk to each other. We tell our stories. It's a love story. At least that's my story, and it is a love story. Thanks.